de químicos peligrosos y las grandes cantidades de agua utilizadas en ese proceso, reporta Pepe Frutos del Foro Argentino de Radios Comunitarias, Farco.
El método conocido también como fracking es el que se usa en el mega yacimiento de Vaca Muerta en Neuquén, pero está prohibido en muchos países, como por ejemplo Francia, Bulgaria y en algunos estados de Estados Unidos, entre otros, por sus efectos contaminantes. En declaraciones a nuestros compañeros de radio La Mosquitera, el geógrafo Marcelo Giró criticó los argumentos del gobierno mendocino para avanzar con este método de extracción petrolera.
Los supuestos controles y la supuesta reglamentación que nos va a mantener a salvo de cualquier problema y que haría de Mendoza, prácticamente que están queriendo venderlo así, estaría a la punta, sería líder mundial en protección y en seguridad de explotación de hidrocarburos no convencionales, ¿no? Es decir, tratar de hacernos creer que los desastres que han ocurrido en muchas regiones, áreas de Estados Unidos que se han abierto a este tipo de explotación de hidrocarburos en formaciones no convencionales o en Canadá, y que justamente han motivado que países como Francia, como Alemania, como algunos estados de los Estados Unidos, como Nueva Zelanda, como Australia, el estado de Queensland, han prohibido esta actividad. Estamos hablando de países líderes en tecnología. Queensland, por ejemplo, tiene una larga historia de megaminería, pero aún así los habitantes dijeron, no, a ver, nosotros no queremos saber nada de este tipo de explotación porque sabemos los altísimos riesgos ambientales que conlleva.
¿Qué es el fracking? Lo explica nuestro compañero Pacho Apóstolo en este informe de FM Pocahuyo.
Los yacimientos mundiales de gas y petróleo se van acabando paulatinamente. El principal insumo energético del planeta es cada vez más difícil de conseguir. La voracidad del sistema hace que se perfeccionen nuevas técnicas para extracción de gas y petróleo en yacimientos no convencionales. Aparece el fracking, o fractura hidráulica, o hidrofractura.
Taladrar en la superficie terrestre un agujero de 4.000 metros, luego en horizontal hacer otro tanto, y eso volarlo con explosivos. Se mete a 5.000 atmósferas de presión, una presión tremenda, una mezcla de agua, arena y un cóctel de 600 productos químicos altamente tóxicos.
El líquido se inyecta, la placa se fractura, el gas y el petróleo suben.
600 productos altamente tóxicos.
Se contaminan las napas de agua profundas y superficiales. Se emiten gases de efecto invernadero en grandes cantidades. Se contamina el aire de todo el lugar. Gran ocupación territorial. Cada pozo ocupa entre 1.5 y 2 hectáreas. Aumenta el riesgo de movimientos sísmicos. Fracking. Cualquier energía a cualquier precio. Una producción de FM Pocahuyo.
El Tribunal Supremo de Derechos Humanos condenó a España por imponer una pena de cárcel a dos manifestantes que quemaron en la ciudad de Girona en 2007 una foto gigante de los reyes. El tribunal considera que la condena a los activistas constituye una injerencia a la libertad de expresión que no fue proporcionada con el fin perseguido, reporta Rafael Cuesta del colectivo Más Voces.
Los tribunales españoles impusieron a Enrique Stern y a Jaume Roura una multa de 2.700 euros a cada uno por eludir la prisión por un delito de injurias a la corona, con la advertencia de que si no la abonaban, se ejecutaría la condena a 15 meses de prisión. Ahora, el fallo unánime de la Corte Europea condena a España a indemnizar a los demandantes con la misma cantidad que pagaron de multa, además de otros 9.000 euros en concepto de gastos y honorarios. La sentencia entiende que imponer una pena de cárcel, la reprobación jurídica más fuerte de un acto, por un delito cometido en el ámbito del debate político es contrario a la libertad de expresión. Se opone además a considerar los hechos como discurso del odio, ya que esa interpretación demasiado amplia de la excepción a la libertad de expresión podría hacer peligrar el pluralismo, la tolerancia y el espíritu de apertura. Para el Tribunal de Estrasburgo, la protección de la libertad de expresión recogida en el artículo 10 del Convenio Europeo de Derechos Humanos excluye el discurso del odio, ya sea por racismo, xenofobia, antisemitismo u otras formas de intolerancia. En este sentido, el Tribunal Europeo no está convencido de que el acto pueda ser considerado razonablemente como una incitación al odio o la violencia. Añade que tras la quema de la foto no hubo conductas violentas ni problemas de orden público. Así, el fallo considera que el suceso debe ser interpretado como la expresión simbólica de una insatisfacción y de una protesta, y no para despreciar y vilipendiar la persona del rey. Precisamente este martes, Esquerra Republicana de Cataluña llevó al Congreso español una proposición de ley para despenalizar las injurias a la corona y los ultrajes a España. El diputado de Esquerra, Gabriel Rufián, defendió la proposición con el texto de la condena del Tribunal Europeo de Derechos Humanos a España.
Esta misma mañana, el Tribunal de Derechos Humanos de Estrasburgo se pronuncia en los siguientes términos. Decide rechazar las objeciones del gobierno español en cuanto a la quema de fotos de los monarcas. Condena al gobierno español a devolver la multa de 2.700 euros a los dos jóvenes condenados por injurias a la corona. Dichas ofensas se engloban, no lo digo yo, lo dice esta sentencia, dentro de la expresión simbólica del rechazo y crítica política a cualquier monarquía y a cualquier cargo público. Suponen una expresión simbólica más de la crítica política legítima. No es odio, es libertad de expresión.
Era el diputado de Esquerra Republicana de Cataluña, Gabriel Rufián. La propuesta defendida por este diputado no fue aprobada, ya que en contra votó la mayoría absoluta formada por el Partido Socialista, Partido Popular y Ciudadanos. Por otro lado, la propuesta sí tuvo el apoyo de Unidos Podemos, Partido Nacionalista Vasco, Compromís y PDCAT.
En México continúa esta semana la caravana internacional de búsqueda de desaparecidos en vida. La periodista Lucía Muñoz, de Surco Informativo, acompaña a las madres de diferentes estados de la República que iniciaron su búsqueda en el estado de Morelos. Para Luisa Díaz, esta es su primera experiencia con la caravana.
Yo tengo la esperanza de encontrar a mi hijo con vida, también adquirir conocimiento porque yo estaba en la oscuridad. Los pocos días que tengo aquí pues han sido de ir aprendiendo de las demás integrantes. He aprendido a tener valor, he aprendido a conocer más gente, he aprendido a sacar fuerzas de donde ya no había para lo mismo. Sobre todo aprendí a dejar mi miedo a un lado. Que luchen siempre por encontrar a su ser querido, que no tengamos miedo, que no perdamos la fe y sobre todo que aprendamos, porque sí nos hace falta conocimiento, como nos han dicho, de las leyes para defendernos.
María de la Luz López Castruita es coordinadora de la tercer caravana de búsqueda de desaparecidos en vida.
Siento que la experiencia en búsqueda, porque antes no sabía cómo buscar, no sabía cómo entrar a un cerezo, no sabía cuáles eran las reglas, cómo ir haciéndolo, ¿no? Todas las actividades que hemos realizado, para mí, ya cada vez se me van facilitando más. Definitivamente las autoridades, que son los que más te obstaculizan, ¿no? Te ponen más obstáculos para poder hacer una búsqueda, porque son ellos los que nos ponen las trabas, nos cierran las puertas, nos ponen condiciones, nos condicionan mucho para entrar a alguna de sus instalaciones. La humanidad, las personas solidarias, se solidarizan con nosotros y nos dan todo para poder movernos, ¿no?, en esto.
Las entrevistas con las madres fueron realizadas por la periodista Lucía Muñoz, de Surco Informativo. El gobierno mexicano ha desoído por años las resoluciones de organismos internacionales en relación a violaciones a los derechos humanos cometidos contra la sociedad civil, pero ahora demanda la intervención de la Organización de Estados Americanos para que actúe contra un candidato presidencial. El gobernante Partido Revolucionario Institucional viajó a Washington para pedir al secretario de la Organización de Estados Americanos, Luis Almagro, difundir a nivel hemisférico el caso del presunto enriquecimiento ilícito de Ricardo Anaya, candidato de la coalición Por México al Frente. Anaya está en segundo lugar en las preferencias electorales después del candidato de Morena, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, y en un lejano tercer lugar está el aspirante priista José Antonio Meade. Aunque el PRI demanda se investiga a Anaya, guarda silencio ante la estafa maestra y otros escándalos de triangulación de recursos públicos en que se han visto involucrados funcionarios del gobierno del actual presidente, incluido el propio Meade. Y aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, del colectivo Más Voces, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV y del diario La Jornada. A nombre del Toshkli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
And up next on Free Radio at 101.3 FM, freakradio.org on your computer, it's the Thursday, March 15th, 2018 edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. We'll be beginning a series of reminiscences about activist David Silva, who died some days ago in Maputo, Mozambique, checking in on opinions and experiences outside in the rain and out of the rain from folks who didn't make it into the River Street campground, who were driven away from the San Lorenzo campground, or have just been outside generally, and more as usual. So stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't.
And it's a rainy day edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Glad I'm indoors. I'm going to begin with playing the city manager's report at the last city council meeting, which was 2 days ago. I didn't make it to that council meeting, mercifully, but you get to hear the audio from the online version. In a few days, you can actually see the video if you have some access to a computer. But right now, since you're listening to radio or computer anyway, you're going to be catching the audio. This is Martin Bernal, the most powerful man in the city, talking about the River Street campground and the city's plans for the homeless.
It's an opportunity for the city manager to report on events since the last council meeting.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. I had a brief presentation on the county and city emergency homeless shelter phase plan and the River Street campground. If you could put the presentation up on the screen, Christina. Thank you. Yeah, it's on that computer. I just have the remote from here. Thank you. So I'll do a brief update for you on these two items. So essentially I'll go over the three-phase plan that we've have been discussing and working on with the county, an update on the Benchlands encampment closure, and then the status on the current River Street camp, and then talk about phase two, which is the next step and next steps. So again, to review the approach that we are taking with respect to essentially trying to increase the capacity of shelter, particularly shelter that provides services and connects people to trying to get them out of homelessness in our community. These are the approach that we have been taking, which is a phased approach, starting with the phase one, which is the River Street camp, which is currently operating now for about 3 weeks. And then the next phase that we're starting to work on already is having a temporary building that increases capacity and provides for similar services. And then finally, ultimately having a permanent building, a navigation center for shelter and day use services.
So, as you'll hear me later talk about with activist Bob LaMonica, who called in today and I'm going to be playing that conversation I had with him, the problem with the city's rhetoric is it doesn't really have a lot of substance to it in terms of A, where things are going in terms of supposedly into permanent housing or permanent meaningful services and jobs or supported housing, nor does it have provision for adequate shelter, even emergency shelter, for the overwhelming majority of homeless people who are outside in Santa Cruz now, or in the next month, or in the next year. There is a step towards it in the sense of acknowledging that far less cost-intensive alternatives like campgrounds are a way to at least provide some kind of minimal shelter for homeless folks from the elements, place where they can store their property during the day, have some kind of privacy, unlike in more conventional shelters. And this is all to the good. The real question, though, is what's the real motivation, what's the extent of it, and so forth. And you'll hear me talk about this a bit with, as I said, activist Bob LaMonica. The city's plan, of course, involved a reduction of shelter space from the San Lorenzo Benchlands campground in order to provide for such important emergency necessities as the Taco Festival that came up recently. I may have that wrong. I think it was there was a day-long event involving all kinds of porta-potties and closing off the area. If it was done as it was done last year, for profit, and essentially allowing a kind of activity, commercialized activity, and some of the activities that are planned this spring are not commercialized. They're community activities, although they are involved leased areas and in some cases private security-controlled functions. But the notion that this is more important than providing space for people who and essentially are in a survival-threatened area, survival-threatened situation, is preposterous, actually. So that's one of the problems with what the manager's overall rhetoric is. But let's hear some more of what Martine Bernal has to say.
So, like I said, the Diversity Camp is up and running, and this one, the camp has a capacity for about 50 to 100 individuals. It's about 62 right now. Provides, you know, basic hygiene services, human services, you know, overnight shelter. It's staffed 24/7. It's people can be there day and at night. It's got on-site neighborhood security. Pets and partners are welcome. There's specific rules of conduct that are provided and monitored, as well as transportation services that are provided. Area Navigation Center, it would include all these things, except it would be, we're now looking at actually another type of temporary facility to accommodate that use, in that it has become difficult to find a lease building for such a temporary period. But we'll give you an update on that. But it would.
And again, the term Navigation Center, which I think they're taking from San Francisco, although possibly from San Diego, they're taking the idea of a large tent from San Diego. San Francisco, I think, has some large buildings, which I could be wrong about this, but there are several so-called navigation centers, which, again, really involve falsification. It's kind of false advertising. They're not navigating anybody into housing in any significant numbers, at least as far as I know. They're navigating people out into the streets again or somewhere else, out of town. This proposed navigation here has a similar kind of false advertising. And while the notion that having a large tent does provide for more room is certainly true, having a large tent means, of course, less privacy for the individuals inside. And, of course, the privacy provided by the current River Street campground is far less than that provided by the San Lorenzo campground, which, for those who are very concerned with hard drug use, is all to the good. But since hard drug use is a significant factor in the homeless community, and it is a harm reduction kind of action for some people, self-medication anyway, and the harm reduction approach would be to understand that it happens and to try to essentially tolerate it insofar as you need to do that, and as a part of the broader need to provide shelter and decent health facilities for folks who are out there, or to let them try to do it for themselves without harassing them with the police. I'm sure many of the people who are using the campground, although I haven't talked to a lot of them since I've been generally interviewing in other places, and they don't let you into the River Street campground. You're not allowed in generally. Although I think I may be setting up a table. Huff may be going down there to Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, to sort of interview people coming out, saying what they think, how they're enjoying it, what they how they feel about it, what the problems are, what the advantages are, how it compares with the circumstances they were in before, and so forth. I've tried to reach the campground today and talk to a couple of the workers there. One of them hung up on me. The other two have not been reachable, but have either voicemails that haven't been set up, or they're just not answering their and returning their voicemails, which is unfortunate. They began with a very... I talked to these same people when they were moving people out of the River Street, or I should say out of the San Lorenzo campground, into the River Street campground, and they were very gushing with positive feeling. One of them was Jennifer, another was Sea Otter. Now, they can't be reached, and or they disconnect quickly. Perhaps they've been given instructions not to talk to potential critics. Perhaps they're, you know, really busy. That it is a rainy day, and there are a lot of people who have a lot of needs there, presumably, although less needs than the needs of those outside that campground, which is the, 85% of the homeless population in Santa Cruz. More from City Manager Martine Bernal.
Certainly increased capacity, which I think would be a tremendous help to the community. And then finally, a permanent navigation center, which would include all these things, except it would be in a indoor facility and also would have that increased capacity.
Martine?
Yes?
Just on that slide, on that phase, the middle slide, that was is it June 2018? To December 2019 is what the dates are for the temporary navigation center?
Yes, and I'll get into that right now.
Okay, just
in a second. Yes, insofar as the timing. So I'll talk about the benchless encampment and talk about phase two, which is that middle slide. So with respect to the benchless encampment, we were able to successfully close that. And if you go back to if you go over to San Lorenzo Park, if you haven't already, it's been rehabilitated. It looks really great. The first scheduled special event happened there this weekend. I was by there this weekend. And
by the benchlands, of course, Martine Bernal means the San Lorenzo campground, because it was in the San Lorenzo benchlands.
It seemed like it was very successful, and the park is in good shape. So that worked out very well. And a number of those individuals that were at the encampment ended up going to the new camp. Not all of them, but many of them did. So now with respect to the River Street Camp, as I noted, this is a temporary approach. It's for a four-month program. It's funded for 4 months only at this point. And that was a commitment we made to the neighborhood to have a four-month program while we worked for the next phase.
A commitment to the neighborhood. The neighborhood, of course, has relatively few residents, a number of businesses, a number of city agencies like a bus storage yard. The notion that somehow the opinions of people living nearby is more important than the survival needs of the homeless community generally, or the rest of the city to have places where people can go to without impinging upon or causing conflict or causing public health and safety problems because there's too many people clustered in one spot. As I fear, by the way, there are in this River Street campground. The people are literally cheek by jowl in these tents. They're within a few inches of each other insofar as you can see through the slatted, barbed-wired fence surrounding them. We proceed.
Towards implementing the next phase. And the next phase really is a stronger partnership with the county to proceed with that part of the program. The program, as I mentioned, provides 24/7 managed, safe, and supportive environment for participants to the camp day and night with the intent to make lasting social service and housing connections towards an exit from homelessness. And it is
housing, again, the phony objective that actually there's no indication that really is a real prospect for the majority of folks who go in there. And it is sort of a selling point. But you might say, well, don't you want to persuade the community to provide some kind of temporary shelter? And the answer is sure, although it might be best if it was a shelter that wasn't linked up to police harassment of people who don't go into the shelter, and that wasn't part of a real program, which at the bottom line was get these people the hell out of sight and out of town as the real objective, not providing real shelter and real services. But you want to claim you are if you want to maybe get folks to go along, by the which I mean middle-class folks or taxpayers or those who are influenced by stories in the Sentinel and by Take Back Santa Cruz Facebook-type stuff. The problem is that because these are false claims in many respects, and the homeless numbers do not diminish outside, and people don't have the services and they don't have places to go, and instead people are sort of falsely assured that they will have less homeless people in their communities and so forth or in the area, because that's really the bigoted undertext of what's really happening. And it doesn't happen. It produces an outbreak of more hostility and in some cases violence, vigilantism, and so forth, which I've been getting some reports of.
Operating successfully, have no major complaints or issues, even from the neighbors. In fact, we've had correspondence how many of them didn't even realize that it was even operating, because it's just been a relatively quiet operation.
And, of course, naturally not. I mean, homeless folks want to keep a low profile. They want to not be identified even as homeless. They want to be able to come and go, go back to a safe place to sleep at night, where they're not managed, to use the Martine Bernal's words, by rules that would not apply to normal adults who live in their homes, normal American citizens, normal people of any nation, except that suddenly these are sort of special classes of people who need to be given special surveillance, and they need three levels of surveillance. They need the workers on the site, so-called hosts. They need the first alarm security guards who guard the entrances and the area right around the River Street campground on 1220 River Street on Highway 9. And they also need the police substation across the street. But, of course, they don't need any of that, really. But the real purpose, of course, is to make sure that people who are homeless don't set up tents outside, as, in fact, they should, to be nearer real services and real paid workers, as they do outside the Homeless Lack of Services Center, in spite of punitive attacks on them by the Homeless Lack of Services Center at Coral Street, penalizing them with so-called, they're being inside the no loitering zone. People still set up tents down in that area because they have to. It's raining out there, folks. It's cold. And they have a right to survive. They have a right to live. And that's something that is fundamentally not being acknowledged by Bernal or anyone else on the city council in any meaningful way.
It has 62 residents currently. We do reserve some sites for emergency referral, so if police is out there or others and encounter the need for providing shelter services, they can be referred to it, which is really great. There's a shuttle service.
And that's, of course, a double-edged sword. What that means is that a person can't say, leave me alone where I am because I haven't got any options. They reserve a couple of places so they can force people to move along. So they can say, well, you can either move along and get the hell out of here, but we won't give you someplace else to go except to this campground. And, in fact, some people may want to do that, but others who have a lot of stuff, they can't take it all with them, or who are hard drug users, and they aren't about to get into a drug program, or who have other problems. They're vets who don't want to be in close quarters with everyone else. And some of the problems, acknowledging, that have been partially addressed, pets, partners, being able to be there during the day, although not with the freedom to come and go. only on the scheduled shuttle provided by the campground, not by bus, not by city bus, as I understand it. Although maybe I don't understand it properly, and if anyone has clearer information on that, I'd like to know.
Which seems to be running smoothly. They've added morning and light evening routes. Many of those individuals do work. For example, they might participate in the downtown streets team, so they get dropped off to do their streets team work. Food is being provided by the Homeless Services Center. The downtown streets team provides maintenance at the facility. The county is providing services 5 days a week, whether it's mental health, basic treatment services, substance abuse, that sort of thing, referral. And they've also been having NA and AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I guess Narcotics Anonymous meetings on site, and people have started to participate in those, which is another really great thing. Again, focusing on people improving their lives and trying to make a difference.
One of the things not mentioned here, but which is really key, and one of the draws of this kind of a campground is access to bathrooms and hot showers, and I don't think they have toilet facilities or bathrooms. Let me take a step back from that. They have porta potties, but the services are improved. Maybe they do have some kind of mobile sanitary facilities. I'm not quite clear on that, and I haven't heard it described that way. But these are sort of elementary things. They're not mentioned by Martine Bernal here, perhaps because they are so absent elsewhere in the city for homeless people. And so to mention them here would be to emphasize perhaps their absence elsewhere for the overwhelming majority of folks outside. No bathrooms at night open. No porta potties available. I don't know that they're. I'm not sure what's going on the San Lorenzo Park. I suspect they're no longer open because the parks, I believe, are now closed at night. But again, I'm not sure. And I will actually send out an email to Mauro Garcia to get some clarification on this and ask him what the situation is. Maybe I can report it on Sunday. But back to Martine Bernal, our highly paid city manager.
And then, like I mentioned earlier, it's expected to operate for 4 months through June of 2018. There are opportunities for people to participate with the camp and get to see how it operates, particularly if you'd like to volunteer to serve food. And we'll also have the opportunity for donations that are coming up pretty soon. So
if you want to get in, at least for a brief period of time, I guess you can volunteer to serve food or give donations at a certain time and place. Why people can't visit you as they could in the San Lorenzo campground, or they can elsewhere in the city, or they can in any middle-class household or in any lower working-class area. Well, because, you see, it has to be government-managed, and they have to worry about the possibly most bigoted people in the community raising the largest stink. And that fear of that kind of prejudice is really what has kept this city under the shadow, the dark, dark shadow of the camping ordinance, the sleeping ban that has hurt and reduced the lifespan of so many people over the years. Hundreds, if not thousands, of homeless people outside, in my view.
With respect to phase two, and phase two would be after the 4 month period. So currently the city and the county staff are working on developing a proposal. So we are looking at a variety of sites, are evaluating the sites, doing the due diligence associated with looking at those sites, the pros and cons, the various issues related to being able to implement. Like I mentioned earlier, we are looking at likely having more of a temporary type structure, perhaps moving to those larger sprung type tents as was done in San Diego, which would actually be more cost-effective than renting a facility, particularly for a short period of time, could expand capacity and provide, again, that 24/7 type services.
And it has to be said that I think one of the things that Huffsters presented and were concerned about, People with Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, when the costly sports arena was opened up downtown, gobbling up parking space galore and creating this huge structure down there, this huge tent, why not do that for homeless folks? I mean, they have porta potties all around it. It's and here they are suggesting now that something like that, which was is being done in San Diego, might be done here. And what's wrong with that? And the answer is, in terms of comparison with the previous situation, it's certainly an improvement. You know, you don't get as wet. But in terms of being managed and treated like a six-year-old or a person with some kind of, brain-dissolving disability, or being essentially being treated like a second-class citizen, that's always been a problem with these kinds of managed programs. Not that, you know, there aren't some justifications for sure for different regulations, but the notion that people cannot take care of themselves, that communities cannot regulate themselves, is ridiculous and elitist, and really is a way of essentially asserting privilege by those who already have it, want to maintain it, and want to extend it, in my view. So I've got to admit that providing a large tent is better than providing nothing, for sure, particularly for people who are so desperately disabled that they just lie down on the sidewalk, as I saw people do after the closing of the San Lorenzo campground, the Benchlands campground, about a month ago, and get rained on and then covered with a tarp that then somebody else picked up and walked away with.
Yeah, the other big piece of this, of course, is looking at the cost of operating and how that would be funded. So we're putting together the budget and the proposals on how to fund that, and the full scope of the services there. So that is expected to come back before council in April, because again, we need to make a decision here as soon as possible and have a proposal before you, and then that would also go to the Board of Supervisors for your review and approval. And that's my update. I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Councilmember Noroyan.
Oh, you mentioned county staff is at the campground right now. Could you break down what type of county staff? Like, is it social workers? Is it mental health workers? And how often are they there?
My understanding is they're there virtually every day, and they're both from the health department and from the human services department. So the staffs in those two departments that provide mental health, there's also actually people there from the County Office of Education on the substance abuse, Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous as well. Also individuals from the Human Services Department that connect people to services that they might qualify for are there as well. We've had also some health issues, so the health departments come over to help with, lice and things like that come up in these such situations. All it's been taken care of and everything, but when you get a bunch of people that have been living on the streets for months and months and months, you come up with some of these issues. And so, again, the facility is super well maintained. It's the hygiene, the sanitation is really outstanding. I was there not that long ago, and what really was striking about it to me in particular was just really seeing the individuals. And there was a couple of individuals that I have seen over the years in wheelchairs that have been, homeless around the city for a long time that, I recognized them, but I didn't, because they just were clean and washed, and they sort of, to me, they look like normal human individuals. I even observed.
And there, although it's kind of touching to hear Bernal expressing some feeling, and it sounds like he's not just, presenting some papier-mâché, put-together propaganda stuff, but, his real experience is. But again, notice, they look like human beings, which kind of indicates the motivation and the reason that, and the basis on which you could put together all the anti-homeless measures over the years that he's done in the last decade or more, particularly regarding the freedom sleepers that he tempted and the survival sleepers that he drove away from City Hall out into the rain, out into the elements, without any kind of alternatives. He did, there's some suggested that he did bring Chief Mills down from Eureka to use his, first gather them together in what looks like a compassionate area, then contract the compassionate area, then move the compassionate area to another smaller compassionate area, and then crack down on enforcement. And then you'll get rid of that homeless population, as some say happened in Eureka. And again, I have incomplete information from Eureka to suggest this is necessarily the complete, full, and accurate narrative of what happened. It is my cynical worst-case scenario fear of what went down. And I don't get a lot of feedback from Andy on what he's been doing or did up there. So I don't know. But if you're listening, Andy, give me a call, 423-4833. If anyone from Eureka has information about how things went down under Mills when he was there until the late spring of 2017, let me know, 423-4833. I should also say at this point that if you want to get $500, you can by finding a year-long space that we can rent for free radio for our studio. It can be indoors or outdoors, 10 by 10 space at least. Electricity, internet, bathroom access somewhere nearby. And you'll get richer, and we will have some decent facilities. Also, if you want to send in any notes on the show, any suggestions for future shows, any reports about what's going on in the streets you think the community should know about, that's a good number to call, 423-4833. Meanwhile, Martine Bernal's report continues.
Individuals coming out of the shuttle, and again, what we're talking about them was they were like individuals coming out of a commuter shuttle going to work, as opposed to what I think maybe some people might think might be the case. So,
and of course, by some people, he's describing his employees, his goon squads from days past, and then the people who are continuing to press for further restrictions on homeless people elsewhere around the city in terms of permit parking restrictions, in terms of RV restrictions. Rochelle Narayan, of course, was the leader of that group, the woman who asked the question, the councilwoman who asked that question.
It's, I think, the variety of services and the difference that it so far seems to be making for individuals is pretty striking.
Councilmember Brown.
Thank you for the report. Just a quick comment and then a question. I'll say, you know, if for those of you, I'm not sure how many of you have been to visit the new campground, but I have been there a couple of times, and it's been wonderful in some ways. I mean, frustrating in others because the space is limited. There are obvious constraints, but also good to see that people do have a safe space, and they're really well-intentioned people.
I have to interrupt Sandy Brown here, council member. Limited space is a good point, that is very limited, but the notion that somehow that's required, there are constraints, no, it's designed to be limited. There's no reason it couldn't be twice as big. Probably the same amount of staff could cover it during that. There aren't that many. I can't imagine there are that many problems that show up. The over-policing is immense. And the self-management of the San Lorenzo Benchlands campground worked relatively well. We don't have massive reports of much police activity or Parks and Rec Ranger activity down there. And there was cooperation between the campers and the Parks and Rec people that came down there, according to what I've generally heard. So Brown is not, she's buying into this, gee, it has to be a limited space stuff, which... in a way, I would like to see a number of limited campground areas all over, because I think that's better than one huge campground, for sure. But if you're only going to have one, make it as large as possible is what's needed, and certainly larger than this one that's packed in at the edge of town, behind barbed wire, of course.
Working there on site. And so my question is, and it's probably a question that I've Chris Monteith isn't here, I don't think. That may require some additional follow-up. But, you know, while I was waiting to be let out, because the gates are locked, and as we've discussed, the entry and exit is limited by the shuttle schedule. So once you're in, unless somebody opens up that lock and lets you out. And... There, you know, while I was there, there was a moment where somebody came up to
the campground and was trying to communicate with somebody who he thought might be inside, but couldn't verify that. And he was very calm, and you know, there were no major issues or reason for concern, but he was unable to deliver a message. He understood that he couldn't find out if somebody was inside the camp because that's a privacy matter, but he wasn't even able to deliver a message in the event that the person was there. And so I worry about the limitation on communications, in particular for people who are kind of stuck inside or outside during most of the day. And I understand that the shuttle schedule has been established to try to mitigate that, but it just remains a concern of mine. So I'd like to know if there are any protocols that have been established for communications.
These are very good questions, and the kind of questions that wouldn't have even been thought of in the last three decades. The circumstances have created this. The reality of homeless people exploding in visibility has made it important to do something, and this is what Mills, Garcia, and Martine Bernal have decided pretty much unilaterally on their own, above the heads of the city council, to do. And the city council said, oh, okay, well, which, you know, I criticize as being, gee, you want a police state and an unelected city manager to run your city and tell you what the hell to do? And I don't think so. But on the other hand, if you've got a reactionary city council that's stagnating and is allowing other people to die outside, then maybe, you know, you do what you need to do. Hence, fascism rises when the real needs of people are not met. And the so-called representative bodies only represent the wealthiest, most reactionary interests in the community. But the issue, I'm surprised rather, not really surprised, but it's eye-opening to hear that this is the concentration camp that Linda the Lark Edwards, way back in the 90s, warned about, that Jane Immler, Calamity Jane Immler, warned about. That, in fact, what's happened, this is what is going on is, gee, they should be grateful to be behind barbed wire. And they've got to have these rules. They've got to be locked in. A whole series of really toxic mythologies is in operation here. And I thought it was bad enough that people, you know, wouldn't be allowed to walk up to the campground. Now they can't get out. The gates are locked except during these very limited schedule times. And more important than that, they can't communicate unless they happen to have a phone, which I don't think there's any phone service provided there that I know of, to people outside. And that assumes that the people outside they're trying to talk to have access to a phone. You can't walk in and hand a note. It's even in welfare hotels where there's massive reduction in curfews and so forth, where poor people in single room occupancy hotels are treated like shit. You don't get this kind of thing where you can't get a message left for you. At least that was my experience in the 80s when I was living in the Tenderloin in the 70s, actually, in San Francisco. But, you know, my memory may be playing tricks on me. Who knows?
And ingress and egress.
Right. I don't know the specifics, but I certainly do know that the staff does have flexibility, and it's there are circumstances when Susie can probably answer this question much better than I can. So here
Thank
she is.
You. I didn't see you there.
I snuck in the back. Susie O'Hara, Principal Management Analyst. Thanks for the question, Councilmember Brown. So there are staff protocols for delivering messages, and whenever we receive somebody at the front gate or if there's somebody who's interested in talking outside, we actually have established security protocols, too. So First Alarm will help, you know, make sure that person is in a safe situation, move them down the fence line a little bit, because oftentimes these conversations can be somewhat challenging. Sometimes they're peaceful, but sometimes they're challenging. And then staff will intervene and make sure that message is heard. With regards to the gates are not locked. The north gate is locked, but the south gate is never locked. So I just did also want to confirm that.
Assuming Susie is correct, that's reassuring. And I'm glad that Linda Edwards would be wrong in that regard, if that's true.
That's helpful. And perhaps it was just, you know, I was there early on in the setup, so maybe there was just kind of a transitional moment of trying to figure out the protocols, but thank you. I appreciate it.
Councilmember Chase and Councilmember Crone.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the presentation. We've had a really ambitious timeline just to get this up and going. There was a huge, huge amount of work that went into it to even make it come into fruition, and April is also another ambitious timeline. Do we feel like that is reasonable for us to get there, and what's the backup plan if we don't?
Well, and that's why we're moving to a more of a temporary type structure, because it's just much more flexible, because much of the infrastructure we've already set up can be relocated much more easily. So a temporary approach is much more doable. And so I think, and that's why we're working on this very deliberately, essentially meeting every week with the county staff, going through all the protocols and accelerating the process. So we hope to do it. If we don't, then we may have a period of time where we don't have that. I hope that we don't get there. You know, we made a commitment to operate this 4 months, and so that's what we've actually, you know, we've been working on phase two, you know, even while we were working on phase one. But now we've really narrowed down the size. I think we have good opportunities, and we'll update the council on that. And I think, it's just a matter of, working out I think the logistics are actually easier now, since we have some experience and kind of have the protocols and all that. So in some ways it's easier. The big piece of it, quite frankly, is also going to be the budget and how to allocate for this. And I think in the end, because both the city and the county are in the same position relative to our budget situation in terms of our outlook, but I think we'll need to look at what we currently allocate. You know, we already spend quite a considerable amount of funds with the winter shelter program that can be reallocated toward this purpose, so we have an ongoing shelter. And then looking at what is really spent in terms of the health and human services functions, and how that can be leveraged to really respond to this really emergency situation and issue. So we'll have to work really closely to come up and be creative and figure out a way to and make this happen. I think we're a lot of the way there. There's a big commitment to do that, but obviously there's no guarantee and promises. And so, but we do commit to bringing something forward to you in April, whatever that might be. Hopefully it'll be something that's everybody can make work.
This guy, have you ever heard so many words saying so little? She asked the question, what's your fallback plan if you don't get this phase two up, this big tent? And he has no answer. I mean, he just talks and talks.
That's my hope, but we'll wait and see until we have a proposal.
Thank you. Councilmember Crone.
Thank you, Mayor. This is costing quite a bit of money, and I personally think that doing this kind of work is good work for the city, and I think I support it. I'm just wondering where we're at. I don't know if you're in a position to say, you talked about being equal partners with the county. Are we talking about in dollar terms yet and resources, or how is that, those conversations working out, if you can say anything about it?
And, of course, we're talking about $90,000 a month for these folks. And if you assume 90 people are there, that's sort of somewhere between 60 and 100 on the high end. That's $1,000 per person per month. A lot of money to put somebody up in one tent. It's a lot of it, no doubt, is going for this, you know, important policing of these dangerous people. And so forth. But here's a little more of Christopher Crone's question.
We have a commitment with respect. There's two pieces to it.
Martine Burnell's answer, rather.
Thus far, that we know for sure. So with respect to the current River Street camp, the county has made a commitment to fund $100,000 of that. And of course, they've also dedicated the resources of the county staff that's providing services directly for the camp. So that has been the partnership with the county. And the city's funding the other 3 months. So that is the current structure. With respect to
Again, the resources that the county is providing are all framed in terms of this dealing with these damaged individuals, and NA, and AA, and mental health. There is some minor hook people up with other services, which, you know, can be helpful. And there's, of course, the mandatory but fanciful mention of housing. But, you know, the kinds of services that ordinary folks would want, you know, might be something like helping your kids get to school, for instance. Or what are you going to do if you get, if you have to get out of here in June and there's no other place to go? Can you get some kind of, you know, emergency food services that are going to be coming up? Clothing, things of that sort. And I don't know. It seems to me that a certain population is being stigmatized here as disabled in a particular way, and so not competent in a particular way, and so in need of fixing in a particular way that ordinary people, which is what Martine Bernal acknowledges, he sees people that these people are. When you, when they are allowed to have privacy, allowed to have an opportunity to sleep, allowed to have a shower, allowed to have at least one meal a day, then what's the need for treating them like criminals or retards or loonies? Far less or none at all.
Phase two and phase three, those are where we're having discussions, because that is more long-term ongoing funding. And I think, again, that's where we have to look at the funding sources that we receive for these services and for these functions, and how can we leverage those funds. So there isn't a specific proposal that's in place yet, but we will bring that forward to you when we have that together. But
in other words, he's flying by the seat of his pants. And notice he's not breaking down the costs of this. Perhaps it is broken down somewhere. And how much is going to pay a lot of cops or a lot of social service workers instead of the money going directly to people to, I don't know, fund their clothing or fund other immediate needs that they have. It's being diverted, as is almost always the case with homeless funding. It's either diverted or it's simply hoarded and withheld.
I think it's clearly understood that you know, the county will be a major partner in that. They've already received direction from their board that they are committed to establishing a permanent navigation center and increased shelter capacity in our county. So,
but notice no specifics at all about the money from the county. Maybe Rochelle Naroyan, who's always going on about how the city must do this in consultation with the county. Maybe she'll pipe up.
You know, it's just a matter of figuring out the details and how to allocate the funding.
It's a matter of actually giving us some of the details, which we aren't getting.
Last question is about tent camping. Will there be any tent camping at the temporary facility or the permanent facility?
You know, we're looking at various options because there are some that might be possible where you could have a larger sprung structure, but even potentially have some outdoor or tent structure or even some indoor tent. Some of the sites we're looking at have more flexibility in terms of providing a larger scope of services, maybe even potentially for vehicles to address some of those issues that we have in the community. So it'd be nice to be able to have some flexibility there in terms of providing a wider range of services. So we are looking at that.
That's included, right? I mean, you don't need direction from the council to include those kinds of options.
Yes, okay. You don't need direction. Yes, we're looking at that.
Thank you, Councilmember Crone. Vice Mayor Watkins.
Thank you, Martine, for your presentation and to the staff for their hard work on this. I just I know that I've discussed and we've talked a little bit about it in the past in terms of an evaluation plan and how we're assessing and monitoring our progress, as well as identifying metrics and indicators for success. I'm curious as to knowing if that's still forthcoming or what the progress has been on that.
Yes. So we obviously, one of the things that we do want to make sure is to look at particularly what happens to individuals that participate in the services and in the facility. That'll be really critical to determine. And we have, like I said, some models with some of the navigation centers, particularly. And these are fairly new. I mean, San Francisco's probably been the lead in California. And they have some models that we're looking at and we could apply. And particularly, it's a little harder with the 4 month project, but certainly with the next phase, which is expected to be, would probably be more like a 2 year phase, and then obviously the permanent one. So the answer is yes, we'll be looking at it.
And again, nothing specific about the parameters of success, how you're going to be able to judge whether it's successful. You know, what's as annoying as Bernal is not answering the specific questions is these council members not following up on it. It's like this is all a bunch of kind of a charade back and forth, a fluff and puff situation where nobody needs the real answers.
That. Do you have an idea of a timeline and when we could get a sense of what that will look like? And
so it was just last week that I would think I was, or no, was it 2 weeks ago that I was here talking about us opening up? And we did commit to coming back within about 4 to 6 weeks to talk about the evaluation indicators for the River Street camp, and then also probably some discussion about phase two and phase three as well.
Thank you. Just quickly, in terms of the budget, you did mention that it's quite costly, and I'm wondering if there's been a cost benefit to this strategy, as well as there's research around grant opportunities and other funding sources to support the effort aside from just city and county funding.
Right, we'll have to look at that and work with the HAP. Unfortunately, what's happened, at least at the federal level, is a move away from emergency funding in terms of grants. While the need has really grown in that area, so that's been an unfortunate situation. But hopefully, I think there are some opportunities out there in the state. There's some state legislation that's in the work and some propositions that are in the works, and some commitments already made at the state level, and also at the local level, there is consideration of potentially a housing measure that may include some set aside for homeless programs and services. So there are some opportunities out there that are emerging and developing that will keep.
And people should be aware that this isn't a Trumpism. This under Obama, they were cutting back funding for housing has been cut back under both Democrats and Republicans for 40 years. But under Obama, there was a shifting of grants from emergency shelter to the so-called an illusory pathway to housing. You may remember, those of you who have been involved in the homeless struggle or been watching it closely, that the Homeless Lack of Services Center cut off meals to homeless people generally back in June of 2016. Was it 2016? No, 2015, I believe, actually. And so there was a shift in the during the Obama years as well. Democrats and Republicans are equally culpable here, or at least they're both culpable.
Keep track of and try to tap in as well. In terms of the cost benefit, I think one of the things that to me is really remarkable about this approach is that, compared to what we've been doing, where, for example, we spent $500,000 roughly on our winter shelter program, which is about 5 months. So we spent about $100,000 a month on a program that provides only overnight shelter for a relatively limited number of individuals. If we actually compare that to what we're doing here, which again, it doesn't include all the in-kind services that are provided by the county, but certainly in terms of the investment the city's made, we're serving, not a comparable number of individuals. Although we could serve more, it's just that the size capacity actually limits that. So there is an ability to expand.
Limitation is, of course, determined by the decision of the city manager, because he's the one who really began this program and ran it through the council. He makes a decision how small or how big it is. So it's not limited. He's limiting it. But I think he's quite correct in saying it's obviously much cheaper to run a campground than to rent the armory or rent huge buildings or transport people all around the place, although there's a lot of unnecessary transportation going to and from this campground as well. still, it's good to hear it acknowledged that campgrounds, which so long denounced as a possible solution by mayor after mayor, council after council, falsely maligned, and when homeless people try to do it, their own campgrounds destroyed, it's finally being acknowledged that, yeah, I guess, all along, the emperor really does have no clothes in terms of this ridiculous argument that it's not good to allow for emergency for homeless people to either shelter themselves or get the emergency shelter they need, even if it's only a tent or a campground.
And the capacity for pretty much the same cost, so there's that opportunity to get even more efficient. But the fact that it's 24/7 and it's full services, you know, I think you get a lot more bang for your buck in that respect.
Sure. I just have two quick last things that I'd be interested in learning, and you don't have to necessarily respond at this time, about what our plan is for SEP populations, families, kids, transition age youth, and how we're working with other types of initiatives in the county and supporting those types of populations. And I, again, don't necessarily need that information at this time, as well as sort of our community outreach strategy and how we're notifying our community members and our other partners about the various stages where we're at and how we're moving forward and articulating that to the community.
Thanks. Yeah,
last thing, I'm sorry, that I wanted to just say. I just wanted to really just comment on how extraordinary of an accomplishment this really was for a particular city to take. And I want to acknowledge really the hard work that was done by so many staff in the city and so many departments, and certainly Susie in particular who headed this up. But the amount of work that was done was really extraordinary on the part of the police department, the parks department, public works, facility folks, the water department. It was really a tremendous team effort that was done in an extraordinary way, very quickly, very competently, and I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Great, I'm glad you did that.
Great. I have a few questions. No other questions on this side. I just want to say that it's good to have this context about where we're going, because I think that having that background that know that the not only from where the bench lands now to the emergency shelter towards a more coordinated strong and equal partnership with the county can help to kind of address some of the issues that have been longstanding here in the city. I mean, we're seeing, you know, people that have been on sidewalks and our parks that have resulted in a lot of different types of issues, not only for our city staff. So it would be good to have, you know, when we have these types of presentations, maybe even someone from the county to be present to kind of reflect on, you know, what their role is moving forward in terms of serving in this partnership, because I know the tremendous work that's taken place from the city staff in terms of bringing us to this point, and I really look forward to kind of the April meeting so we can talk about what that looks like in terms of a navigation center. The one thing that I feel like it hasn't happened is the partnership with in terms of the budget. You mentioned that there was going to be a contribution from the county for this initial emergency, has that been confirmed?
Yes, they've indicated that. I believe it's going to be formally approved by the board on March 20th, but we did receive confirmation that was what would be contributed to the program.
And if there's any sort of, you know, as we work forward for the agreement for the phase two, is there any indication that this is viewed as being a bridge towards getting to phase two, where that partnership will continue beyond, let's say, our June date?
Yes, that's certainly the way we've been working, yes.
And for whatever reason, if there's any sort of change, when will we know whether or not that will be the case? Would it be that April meeting when we'll have a clear agreement?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Well, I think this is something where, I guess finally, we did have a policy action when we first looked at the Homeless Coordinating Committee recommendations, looking about shared geographic placement of facilities. I know in prior years we looked at where facilities are located, and I was wondering how that's playing into our discussions.
With respect to, and I think you're really talking about phase three, which really is looking at the more permanent facilities. And certainly at the staff level, the discussions we've been having with respect to that is that there is a need to have a number of facilities throughout the county to provide those services, you know, North County, Mid County, South County. So I think that is the goal, to have a variety of facilities around the county.
So in terms of your discussions now, those are factored in about looking at this not just being a city facility?
Yes, I mean, I think that's the discussions in terms of the long-term goals, yes.
And Gerasus is again showing his endless interest in making sure that he can dump as much of this in the county as possible. And again, sort of to maintain and justify the city's abusive legislation, which he has almost universally supported against homeless people, whether it's standing on a median or holding up a sign after dark, whether it's increased harassment of people in the parks through the stay-away orders, which are suddenly court-free and police-mandated. Terrazas has been the leader in all this stuff, and he and Narayan have been pushing to suggest, you know, that I guess perhaps under pressure from right-wing critics who are saying you aren't doing enough, is that there's a county problem. It's a county problem, and the reality, of course, is that Santa Cruz City is the county seat, and the services are located essentially right next to the city and the Emmeline Center. And some of them are in the city. The jail, for instance. At least one of the jails. Anyway, let's hear a little more. And then we'll get a little music. I'm going to take a break from this soon, so don't give up.
And then there'll be more discussion in April when we have that come back to us.
In April, the focus will be on phase two, because, again, we're focusing on phase one and phase two. I don't know how much we'll have on phase three, other than we are sort of are looking at least the identifying sites, so we may have, you know, some update on that. Not as much, obviously, on phase two, because that's our focus.
It'd be great, as Vice Mayor Watkins was saying, to have some sort of indication of what to expect moving forward. So I'll look forward to the presentation in April as far as what the next steps in the budget, because I know as this approaches, we're going to have a really difficult budgetary discussion. So I want to make sure that we're clear on the commitment that we're able to make at this time. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that.
And that mercifully concludes the city manager's report, and the dialogue with the city council went on much longer than I thought. I didn't. This is the first time I've heard it. But some of it was interesting. A lot of it was windy. And there's more to the city council meeting, which I didn't go to and I haven't watched. But I may do a little bit of that before the Sunday meeting and put you all to sleep with more city council blah, blah, blah. Or maybe not. Maybe I'll just skip the whole thing, which is actually more likely. Let's listen to a little music now from the parody project. It's called He Doesn't Know the Territory, which is a parody of the opening scene from the Music Man musical.
Slashing the student loans, slashing the Medicare, slashing the foreign aid, slashing the Superfund,
slashing the PES, slashing the learning center, slashing the low-income energy assistance,
slashing on the federal work-study program, slashing track and the endowment for the arts.
What do you talk?
But the money is going to the people at the top. It's a new entitlement. It's different than it was.
No, it ain't. But you gotta know the territory.
Why is the money at the top mean the trouble and they just want more? Wanna get all the gold. Now the party in power gonna run up the debt from money to the top.
Yes, sir.
Nobody worries about the high cost of war. No help for the poor anymore.
What do you talk? What do you get it?
That's not it. Take a gander at the cost, at the service cost, at the present day cost, at the Medicaid, Social Security, entitlement cost.
What do you talk?
What do you get it? You can talk, you can figure, but the money is going to the people at the top. That's a new entitlement, and it's different than it was.
No, it ain't, but you gotta know the territory.
Why, the invention of the robot into trouble. Robots put the product in the sanitary package. Robots build it, and they put it in the sanitary package. Maybe every day, working man, obsolete.
All
the jobs went out the window with the internet, undermining all the local stores. Made it hard to get a job, made it for the art.
No, it isn't, but you gotta know the territory.
Gone with the Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps. Gone with the poor guy assistance programs. Gone with the aid for the destitute kids.
Wait, the problem is coming from the hill.
From the hill?
Hill.
No! Yeah, the problem is coming from the shale on the hill.
He doesn't know the territory.
What's the problem?
or the obsolete jaws, obsolete, or the robots building it and filling every sanitary package or the funnel to the top.
Just a minute. Never worry, Bobby Fly. Or a dog on scene.
He's just a band beat, bell ringing, big mouth, great going necker, nothing rip roaring, BS in a bullseye con man. That's the thing with the shell on the hill.
Gosh, what's his line? He's a fake and he doesn't know the territory.
He's just a con man.
He's a what?
He's just a con man. He's a span of seed to the people in the towns. Wants money from the military, money for parades. He likes big walls and the military tanks. And the soldiers marching in the uniform, saluting all the while like the Chinese do or the Russians or the French.
Well, I don't know much about that, but I do know we can't afford to pay for big parades and walls. No, sir. Overthrow a country, perhaps, and here and there a drone strike.
No, the fellow's those fancy imaginary threats. I don't know how he does it, but he lives like a king, and he grits, and he golfs, and he blathers, and he lies. And when he gets caught, certainly, boys, what else? He blames it on us.
Yes, sir!
When he gets caught lying, certainly, boys, what else? He blames it on us.
Yes, sir!
But he doesn't know the territory!
Okay, well, today is Thursday, the 15th of March, and I'm talking with activist Bob LaMonica, who is a longtime colleague of David Silva, who died earlier this week overseas. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Robert, how are you? Thank you.
I'm still walking, unlike David.
Yes.
The reason I'm calling you is because you have... Well, you've recently been at a number of the Huff meetings, albeit not for most of the meeting, but for much of the meeting, some of the meeting. When David Silva joined you there, he too was at the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meetings around civil rights issues. You shared, I think, a concern about both homeless civil rights and also broader civil rights for renters, members of others in the community, and so forth.
Well, that would have been the last time I saw David. Would have been at your... At the Huff meeting, maybe like a month ago, Robert?
I think so, yeah. I think he took off for Mozambique at that time.
And David was physically weak. My sense is that David Silva was on a quest to find his identity. He would go to places like Goa and Mozambique and Macau, which were Portuguese colonies right at one time.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was going the second time to Mozambique when he died. I knew him a long time. I knew him going back probably to the early 90s, probably right around when you and I met. He was certainly an activist in the honest sense of the word. I mean, I got to say that, don't you think? I mean, David Silva. I don't know, a pretty open, nice guy. I had met his partner. I think his name was Steve.
Yep, yeah, it was.
Yeah, Steve died. David moved to, what, Fresno? Modesto or somewhere like that.
Somewhere in the Central Valley, yeah.
And his partner died, and I think his mom died, and he moved back to Santa Cruz. I remember him calling up on your show when he was homeless. You must remember that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was quite outspoken about that around 2010, 2011, when he came back, couldn't find housing, and he experienced the things that he had fought against when he was here. And 10 years before, you and he and others, myself as well, worked on the initiative to end the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance.
Absolutely. Things have evolved in their way. Certainly more people are aware of the issue than ever before, but there's also more of a presence than there's ever been. You and I probably disagree with this attempt, whatever they're calling the River Street
Campground or the Boneyard Campground.
Right. I mean, it's an attempt. They're trying to figure out how to do it on a larger scale that will be acceptable to people. I don't know whether David knew about that or not before he left.
Oh, I think he did. I think, I don't right at this moment recall. I think his position was a somewhat critical one because the problem that we had, many of us at Huff had, and you were there for some of this discussion, was that this new Boneyard campground which has barbed wire and some razor wire actually at the side of it, and you can't have visitors, and it's all the tents are literally within 2 inches of each other. And there have been some improvements. I mean, this is the first ever, as you pointed out, city-sponsored campground, but it was used, for some of us believed, as a way of justifying the elimination of the larger, freer campground in San Lorenzo Park.
Well, of course it was, Robert.
Yeah.
I think that David was gone. That campground was set up March 1. He may have been at the city council meeting where you and I were when they discussed it. And passed it. And it was also when they passed the rent freeze.
Yeah, he was certainly there at a number of the council meetings. In fact, he made it a point to be a council watcher, sat in the front row, spoke out on a number of issues.
A very well-known, interesting character, David was. I assume there's going to be a memorial. I talked to Laura Tucker. I think there's one in the works. There's got to be some things done. I think her niece is going to take control of the situation. David's niece, I'm sorry. But you just come back to David for a bit. He was a very sincere character, person, individual, human. And he tended to be towards the side of the disenfranchised.
Big time, yeah.
He was also able to take on radical issues. I knew David as I knew you during the days of the Danner recall, and David would have been witness to the cops that would always be around the booth when we had a booth at an event, and he was aware of the intimidation. People were afraid to sign the recall.
And, of course, that was Art Danner, who at that time was district attorney.
Right, exactly, which is, you know, it seems so far away because the guy that we've got presently seems to be a pretty open person, even though you might disagree with him. I don't think he's got the paranoid approach that Danner developed, right? When you can falsify time cards and get away with it, I mean, you've got some power, right? And I think that was what we all saw at the time. I mean, I ran into Ed Fry maybe a year ago, and I asked him, Ed, if you had known about the time cards falsification before the election, what would happen? And he said immediately, I would have used it. And of course he would, right? You know, there was an assistant DA on Danner's staff that was snorting coke, so they put her on administrative leave illegally until after the election, then they fire her.
Right.
Anyhow, I don't want to go into that story, but I knew David had the courage to stand up. Okay, he was there. He was there in the, I think I probably met David in the early days of medical marijuana, which is when I think I met you, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
So he had that kind of that courage of presence, right? While still being a nice guy, right? I think he was harassed to a certain degree. I think that didn't the police?
He was present at the 1996 city council meeting in the summer when there was a very vocal homeless protest. In fact, a number of people chained themselves to the furniture of the city council. It was a form of a very, very vocal protest. And David was not specifically a part of that protest. He was simply turning in petitions asking for an end to the sleeping ban. And the sergeant-at-arms, Sergeant Andy Crane, otherwise reportedly a jovial, friendly police officer, threw him against a pillar outside, which actually damaged David. He was then running for city council in the 1996 race. And David then sued Crane and the police department and actually came away with thousands of dollars. I'm not sure how much, somewhere between $5,000 and $25,000, I believe.
David, I remember primarily as having a very high degree of integrity. I'm sure he was not perfect, Robert, but I mean, he had that integrity. He would stand up. He didn't have the animosity that sometimes people have if you dare to disagree with them. And I think I like that very much about David Silva. He had a mellow way about him and a witty way about him. And I really appreciate, you know, one thing about your Huff meetings is meeting the old timers you know, Linda LeMaster. I rarely see Linda LeMaster. I think I've seen Steve Argue at your gigs. So it's really a very pleasant thing, and it would have been the last time I saw David, and that would have been sometime in February. He was frail when he left, if my memory is right.
He seemed to vacillate differently. He was physically frail. I think he was hobbling on a cane or some
sort. Right.
But he was also psychologically, I think he was getting stronger. He, in the past year or two, he'd been very, very, how would you put it, flippy. It was hard for him, was hard for me to take seriously much of what he said. But he became more and more coherent. And he carried on toward the end what he called a sleeping band fast, where he would ask people to call city council and indicate to them that they had not slept throughout the night between 11 and 8:30 in the morning, which is what the law mandates anybody outside or in a vehicle has to do. You have to stay awake or else you're actually a criminal. That's still on the books, although it's being enforced less intensely, certainly, than it was a year ago. But David was still concerned that this was a law in the books. He would sit in the front row of the city council meetings. He would stand up and make announcements. His funeral, by the way, is going to be held tonight at 10 o'clock in Mozambique, Maputo, Mozambique.
Oh, well, thank you.
For anybody who wants to jet over there, it's at the Cemeterio de Micha Futane, which I probably have wrong.
His body's going to be there.
His remains, his corpse, or whatever. I'm not sure if they've, you know, burned him up and, you know, cremated him or what. Not clear.
We should talk about David Silva's hate-free zone.
That was in 1999, I believe. I think it was
garnered
voted
him national publicity.
He was voted down, but it was.
He told me that the phone was ringing off the hook when the news got out. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? I mean, the hate-free zone. He was an interesting character that would even make such an attempt. Right. However,
of course, he was concerned with the rights of transgender, but particularly gay people, gay and lesbian people, who of which he was one, and of which he was also an HIV survivor.
Yeah, that's right. David was an HIV survivor.
Quite a survivor. Right. His cell count had gone very, very low, and you know that was in the 90s, and you know it's now 2018. And he survived to the age of, I think he was 72, 73. I'm not quite sure of his exact age.
Yeah, people have been guessing at that, too. He was at least 72, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard now as high as 77, which I don't tend to think he was.
Probably not.
Early 70s. He was settled up at the St. George. He got a settlement from the VA, didn't he, that allowed him to travel.
I believe so. He traveled usually with a companion. This last time, because of a screw-up or because of a cancellation or maybe a falling out, I'm not sure what the story was, he didn't travel with the person he intended to travel with, which is too bad because one of the reasons he has died there, some say, over there, is because he was in a hospital and couldn't get access to his money or didn't have enough money. The hospital was constantly demanding more and more money to pay for him because they put him on a respirator because he had a pneumonia. And they were giving him the wrong drugs for the first few days, thinking he had an HIV problem, when in fact he apparently had mastered that. This was simply some bizarre other infection that showed up.
Wow.
And they eventually transferred him to the public hospital, which apparently is free, or maybe cheaper, I'm not sure which. But they don't have X-ray machines of the same quality. They don't have respirators in the same way. Although apparently, they had him on a respirator on and off. He apparently did become conscious a little bit for a few days on and off. He spoke to his niece, and I think we'll be playing an interview with her on Sunday. Which,
oh, great, Rob.
As well as some of his, I have, if you ever want to go online to the Huff website and listen to the old audios I've got much of the show that I've done audioed, fascinated as I am with my own voice, of course. And
well, when did, when did you meet David?
I do not know exactly when, but I know that we became... We knew each other by 96 when he was gathering petitions, when he was running for city council, and then when he had to retire from the race because of the assault by Sergeant Andy Crane, which Crane was never prosecuted for, of course.
I would venture that we met David about similar, the early 90s. And it probably would have been around medical marijuana, because that had a large gay support, right, 1992, Scott Imler. I'm pretty sure that's when I connected with David initially. Mm-hmm. An interesting character, a nice guy, an activist with a heart, you know, who was a bit of a showman, but, you know, who isn't, right? You know what I mean? David had that streak in him, especially towards the end. He was a nice guy. I enjoyed meeting David and chatting with him and bouncing off him. He was an interesting character. Mm-hmm. I miss him. It still kind of floors me, but one thing about getting old is that people start dying around you with greater frequency, right?
I haven't really noticed that yet, but I'm afraid I'm going to. So.
Yeah, no, it just seems to be unavoidable. Robert, I have to assume there's going to be a memorial for the guy, and maybe even the city council will take a minute. He was quite the presence of city council meetings, and maybe they'll take a minute off. I hope someone puts together an obituary for the guy. I'm sure they will.
Yeah, I think activist Laura Tucker is working on that. And you probably don't remember, but Linda Edwards, when she died, she was given a Memorial Day. I think it's in November. And that was passed, proposed by then-Mayor Catherine Byers, and I think it was finally endorsed under Mayor Rotkin, even though I think she probably would have turned over in her grave because she didn't think much of either of those council members.
Oh, I would bet.
But, you know, David Sullivan...
She's the one that went to jail for... She said that I'm beyond rehabilitation.
That was Sandra Loringer.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. No, Linda... But Linda Edwards went to jail many times more than Sandra Loringer and was far more... She was outside and was a constant, strong voice for independence and dignity for homeless people. She would have probably been at odds with you in many regards, Bob, because she didn't believe in... imposing a different set of regulations on homeless people than, let's say, on people in houses.
Now, if you're referring to the River Street camp, I don't see how they could have done it any other way as a government.
She would have called it a concentration camp. And indeed, insofar as it has curfews, which ordinary people are not bound to have, and which wasn't the case, for example, at the San Lorenzo campground.
But that was not sanctioned.
So what?
It was tolerated. It was like a gray area.
What I'm saying is that's how she would have described.
Right.
But the reason I'm talking, I mean, you know, David Silva, I think he too
would have opposed it. I think I would agree with you that there are vocal oppositions, and to some degree, their opinions I think are worthy to be stated.
It was very important to David. He made this very clear that human rights are the issue that he is primarily concerned about, although he also is big into social services. He was a welfare worker for a long time here and elsewhere in other counties.
Yes.
But he would make this point every time he stood up at city council, which was every time he talked about the issue during the oral communications doghouse period at 5:30. And they allow people 2 long minutes to talk about something that they won't talk about themselves. He would say it doesn't matter what kind of services you provide to people. You have to make sure their rights are protected when they're not getting their services. And when they are getting their services, for that matter. And that, of course, Santa Cruz, as a city and many other city governments, have never done that I'm aware of. And he was a constant spokesperson about around that. Although he was also a person who liked to hobnob with, that's not quite the right word. He was close to politicians around the progressive turn of the millennium. Sugar, Crone, and Fitzmaurice, who came into office and creating a so-called progressive majority, was someone who he was closely involved with in trying to establish safe sleeping zones, which he thought he had done, but then he was betrayed by Councilmember Catherine Byers at the last minute, and by Mayor Sugar, who had him hauled off to the psych ward in the spring of 2000 because of his opposition. He was going to speak about the sleeping ban and also the Nueva Vista Dolphin Lee project, which was an attempt essentially to destroy low-income housing in order to create less of it, which actually, without providing relocation guarantees for the Latino population. He was close to people in power for different periods of time in his life, and that may be, you know, kind of relate to your sense of his being, he was something of a diplomat.
And more from the conversation with Bob LaMonica about David Silva and assorted topics, but first a little musical aside.
A man talks through his tweets. He says, why can't I use those weapons now? Why can't I use nuclear weapons? This makes my job so hard. If thousands die in a war, they're all gonna die over there. They're not gonna die here. We'll end up in our graveyard. Damn, hunting rages. I'm looking for a man fun. Far away from his big white door. Bad advice from his sages. Posturing in the dead of night. This kind of thing could get us into a war. Disregarding, we all shall. Call me big and petty, mean and petty, don't explain his rationale. A man talks through his tweets, he says, I think I'm actually humble. I'm really very humble, much more humble than you would understand. I have a very good brain, I have the steadiest hands. Only me can make us great again, now that our greatness is gone. I will build a great wall, nobody builds walls better, or as inexpensively. For a song, mark my words, believe me. The beauty of me is that I am very rich. Disregarding, we all shall. Call me mean and petty, but mean and petty might explain his rationale. His rationale. A man talks through his tweets, he says, no one respects women more than I do. I just start kissing them, I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything, anything. You're surrounded by the sound, the warrant of women's anger, the revoked amelioration. He looks around, around, sees gold in the architecture. He says nobody reads the Bible more than me. Hallelujah. He deserves our disregard, and disregard, and we all shall.
Explain his rationale, a parody of You Can Call Me Al by The Parody Project. Back now to the conversation with Bob LaMonica about David Silva and other things.
And in fact, he and I were on different sides of issues at different times.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why I like that approach. Even if one disagrees 180 with somebody, to have that approach. But quite often people, they will, you know, tell you what they think and walk away. You know, they don't want to hear anything that disputes it, including like talking about the River Street camp, Robert. I sense from the beginning that you and I were going to be opposed somewhat. I think it's the mere fact that something was done is historical. You agree with that?
It depends on what you mean by historical. I mean, certainly it's the first time that the city has supposedly, well, we're talking about a 3-month temporary encampment. And, you know, we're talking about some way to justify cutting back police and parks and rec expenditures against homeless people who you're trying to drive away from the downtown core. I mean, that's why they created the River Street shelter. That's why they created the free meal and the homeless community resource center. It later became the homeless lack of services center, as I call the homeless services center. They wanted to move the homeless out of sight and out of town. That's all they wanted to do. It has very little to do with improving the homeless as a group. So when you call it historic, you know, I blanch a little bit, but I understand what you mean.
And it wasn't the first. I mean, the first would have been San Diego.
Well, I mean,
the model for Santa Cruz is San Diego's.
Unfortunately, yes, it isn't a particularly good model if you talk to other homeless activists.
Well, you see, this is where we part, and the degree of freedom that you're expecting to be...
Not just freedom, it's services as well.
Services, whatever word you want to use, freedom and services, freebies.
Dignity. That's not freebies. See, there David Silva would take issue with you.
All right. I mean, and I'm fine with that. But, I mean, to me, when the government gets involved in 2018, it has to have... procedures established, which what they're calling navigation centers now, right? Okay, so you end up at the River Street camp. Well, they're going to try to get you channeled. If you've got some mental problems, they're going to try to get you channeled. Drug problems, they're going to try to get you housed.
You're buying the government line, Bob.
What on earth could be wrong?
They're not navigating people anywhere, generally speaking, and that's true in San Francisco. I'm not familiar with San Diego, but San Francisco has sort of similar. They have navigation centers that are indoors rather than outdoors. But the problem is, it's phony. They aren't navigating. It's the same thing like the continuum of care or like all the other rhetoric that comes out of the city council. It doesn't have anything to do with sending people into real housing and real jobs as a general rule. It is a form of cosmetics that provides middle-class jobs for people, and it provides the cover for them to engage in sweeps of the real places that homeless people are gathering and trying to survive. And that's why it's so infuriating when people kind of come up and say, well, gee, isn't it wonderful? Isn't it historic? Isn't it a great thing? And the answer is, if they were really doing what they said they were doing, there would be an argument for what you say. But I'm not persuaded that's the case.
They're trying to figure out the logistics.
I don't think they're trying to figure out anything.
On a larger scale. You've read, I think,
No, you give them too much credit, Bob. At least we disagree on that. So.
No, it's my sense is there, and not just my sense, but what the press says, what Martine Bernal says.
Bernal is the city manager, and the press is a mouthpiece for the police department. What are you talking about? I mean, I'm not interested in what they say. I'm interested in what you, Bob, with your own eyes see.
I say there was no other way, and if I were, if I had any governmental authority, it would be, something similar to what they've got. You cannot have just an open-ended campground.
They had it in the San Lorenzo park for 4 months, and it worked okay. I mean, it's true that, you know, it was limited itself. They were cutting it back in the same way that they cut back the occupation in 2011.
What you're saying, Robert, is that you don't mind people living in tents indefinitely.
Unless there's housing, you bet your ass. And there was no housing, there is no housing, and there will be no housing, at least for the next 2 or 3 years. So everything else you talk about is pipe dreams and propaganda if you're claiming that. That's a phony argument. That's the kind of argument that I got from Carol Boozenhardt in Take Back Our Town, or you hear that from Take Back Santa Cruz, which is, you know, that, oh, these are people, homeless enablers. They just want homeless people to live forever outdoors. No, that's unfortunately their choice that they have to make now, and there aren't options, and therefore to claim there are is hogwash. But, you know, I agree that...
They're trying. You've got to get...
No, I don't.
Some credit.
I don't.
Attempt.
I don't. I don't have to. No. Because they had something better, and they in order to eliminate it, in a way, they created this little Potemkin village off to the side.
Use that phrase, Potemkin village, like a lot of people are going to know what it means.
Well, Potemkin village is, go ahead, tell us about
front.
It. Go ahead.
Big front.
It's something used in the Soviet Union to give the illusion of a happy village. And actually, it's not like a Potemkin village because they don't let anybody in. You can't get in there. You try to walk in as a visitor, they won't let you.
I've heard the phrase, and maybe this is being an overly used phrase recently, but perfect storm. The homeless situation has skyrocketed for a variety of reasons, including mental illness, including drug abuse.
No.
Including the cost of housing.
That's the main reason. That's the main reason. And the fact that
and
the cost of medical care, that too.
What needs to happen with massive housing, you're talking about a rather significant tectonic shift, including in the community of Santa Cruz, which is not quite ready for yet.
Not quite, no.
I want to give
capitalism,
not just Bernal, because I think Mills has some handiwork.
He's the city manager.
Yes, the chief of police.
And
for attempting to create a model to get people accustomed to the idea that America has a crisis with housing and with the poor. This is happening all over the state of California.
Well, I would normally just reject what you say out of hand, but I have to also acknowledge that the rapidity with which the city council passed the rent freeze and just eviction protection in an emergency measure a month ago I think what it really indicates is they're afraid of the initiative. And they're afraid that if they don't pass the rent freeze and the landlords get together and raise all the rents, they'll have mobs of angry renters on their hands that, will be weathered with the pitchforks and the torches, and they'll really be in trouble. So I think they're a response, and also to a very rather well-organized rent control effort that you pioneered 2 decades ago when they tried to run you out of the farmers market for circulating applications.
Yes, in fact, and it's too bad. There wasn't a bandwagon. This was like, I think, 1999 or 98 or 2000. By the time it came back to Santa Cruz, which would have been last year, there was a bandwagon all over the Bay Area of cities launching rent control. Okay. So where there's a bandwagon, there's a way, right? More power to them. I'm doing a little bit of help for signature gathering. I very much support rent control. It's a statement. And people say things like rent control doesn't work. Well, nothing works, right? The minimum wage doesn't work, whatever that means, right? It's an attempt to mitigate an issue that needs regulation.
Let me ask you this.
All the shortcomings of rent control, Costa Hawkins, it makes a statement about housing.
Bob, let me ask you, I mean, I think we both agree on that, and probably almost all our listeners agree, although I may have a landlord, Darius, on shortly to defend his opposition to rent control. But you're living in a place, the De Anza mobile home park. What do we call it, trailer park?
Well, you can call it whatever you want. It's a very nice place. We had rent control when we moved in here. We now have a 34-year lease, I think it is. The rent control was stripped away by
Rotkin and Kennedy, and among others. Yes, I remember.
I still can't believe it. I'm actually shocked. If they wanted a fancy rent control measure that caps the sales price, okay, then you got to monitor it. If you can't monitor it, don't do it.
Which is why
rent control was lost in the city of Santa Cruz. They had this fancy PC cap on the way you could sell your house. The price. It was the same cap, the same CPA cap that the owner of the property could raise their rent to. Which is fine. I'm fine with that. But they didn't monitor it. Okay. And it was a hole big enough to drive a truck through. And when you've got legions of lawyers that are well paid, they're going to find those holes.
Well, I remember that was one of the arguments when they destroyed the De Anza rent control. And when De Anza turned tail and ran, I should say not all of them, but the leaders, they got the matter. They were going to turn back the city council with a referendum, and they stopped. and they were scared to do it, and they allowed the city council to essentially impose that 37-year lease on you.
Well, the reason, if my memory is right, and maybe it's not, but it was an either or. Either you stop gathering signatures, or we're going to yank the 34-year lease, and that would have been no protection at all.
Except they could, you know, if you did get it on the ballot, and the referendum did overturn the city council, it would presumably return to the rent control previously, would overturn their decision, and it seemed to me that you had the support to do that, but that some of the, you know, that people kind of they lost their nerve. But you know, aside from that, what my question to you is: this was, you know, way back in 2004, 2003, I don't know, around that time.
Right.
What has been the result of this 37-year lease? How many people have left? Has the quality of the park changed?
This is a 55-plus, generally speaking, park, right? And let me say this first: it's beautiful here. It's quiet. Right up against the ocean.
How many people live there?
How many people live here? There are, I think, 198 sites. So maybe 400 people live here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And which is one of the problems with the attempt to do an initiative for 400 people. It's not that easy to get support, as much as you might think. Well, when the city council got together and organized the rent control ordinance, right, just like the county has done for the unincorporated county, but it's a much stronger style of ordinance or statute with in the sense of the county without that proviso of a cap on the sales price. So it's much easier to argue and win when challenged, right? The county, in terms of affordable housing, one of the biggest stocks of affordable housing in the county are, quote, mobile home parks.
Right, but Manufactured Homes, which was the group that was fighting the city and the reason the city attorney tucked tail and ran and didn't the Kennedy-Rotkin thing passed, was, you know, they were losing all their battles all over the state. They lost 11 out of 12 battles, as I understand it. So it was, they weren't necessarily going to lose it. It's just the council didn't want to spend the money to fight
this. That's exactly right. I see it as a one of the most disingenuous political acts that I'm aware of around here. If you're going to enact something, you're going to figure out how you can back it up. If you can't back it up, don't enact it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, really, they left a lot of people in the lurch. And, you know, the rents, people are paying four times what we're paying.
How many people would you say have had to leave, or how many units have had rents raised on them in the last 14 years?
I would say half. And here's the interesting caveat or part, Robert, is that because of the cost of housing in Santa Cruz, if you're paying $3,000 a month rent for a space at De Anza, you know, it's competitive. People are moving in. Okay, they've never stopped moving in, but there's been a surge of people moving in.
What's the nature of the people coming in? Have you had
they're
much?
They're much wealthier.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be candid.
Yep.
Well, we're here until I think 2037 before they can jack up the rent, right? I don't know whether I would not be in town if it weren't for De Anza. You know, our we have a nice manufactured home in the back of the park, but it's beautiful, and I'm very grateful. But I couldn't afford to live in this town, not the way the rents are now, right?
Right.
People are paying $1,000 for a room in a house, even 12.
Well, I think... I would like to salute you for fighting on this issue.
You know that there's going to be nonprofit affordable housing built next to the Red Church in that parking lot, right?
I think you either mentioned it at a Huff meeting or perhaps I heard it somewhere else.
Yeah. So this town is changing. Santa Cruz is changing. Is that my phone or yours?
It's probably your fault, Bob. I'm completely blameless, as you know.
The beep. I'm getting a beep.
Incoming call for you. Why don't we wind
it
up?
Yes, it is.
Let's wind it up, and if you got more to say, we can talk again. I'll play some more thoughts if you have some new memories of David Silva, who again has a memorial tonight, half a world away, 10 p.m. Think of David, because they're putting him in the ground over there at that time. So.
He was an interesting character and a good guy.
Hey. So are you, Bob.
Robert, thank you.
All right.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Some people say a man has the freedom to choose, but the people in power never walked in his shoes. A walk in his shoes wouldn't make them see that choices are hampered by poverty. You take 16 Tums 'cause your stomach's upset, a big tax burden and a lot of debt. You know they'll take you for more and more to feed that monster called the permanent war. You were born into a world that the wealthy control. You can purchase a vote if you sell your soul. You can sell your soul, but the bid's not high, and you'll be lucky if it pays for the food you buy. It takes 16 tons for the ache in your gut. Your Social Security's about to get cut. Your Medicare and Medicaid have got to go because of corporations on the public dole. You could tell them they can stick it where the sun don't shine. What's theirs is theirs and what's mine is mine. But you'll never stand a chance standing up to the man, 'cause the future for you was never part of the plan. You got 16 years of school complete. You got yourself a debt you can never defeat. It's no accident you're stuck with the bill to pay. It's designed to define you till you're old and gray. Seems you gotta have insurance just to stay alive. A lot of men didn't, and a lot of men died. But there's a two-party system, and that's the deal. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You take 16 Tums 'cause your stomach's upset. The bottom of the ladder is as far as you get, but it serves a purpose for those in control. You won't cause them no problems when you're deep in the hole.
Yeah, that was 16 Tums by the Parody Project. We're going to close out with some interviews from Berkeley, from the streets from a few days ago, and back on Sunday with lots more interviews and updates and whatever we can find that's happened between then and now. So give a call to 423-4833 if you've got anything you want to add to the show, if you've got any questions, and you can check out past shows on the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org. So it's Berkeley 10 to 5. On, what is it? Today's the 13th of March.
How you doing?
Hey guys, how's it going?
Good.
A little tired, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
All right.
Yep.
And that's the police. Two squad cars parked in the way, but nobody in the vehicles. Chris?
Patrick Jones?
Hey Patrick, you have a sign you made yourself?
Yes.
And what does it say?
It says, traveling on human kindness, if it still exists, food, cigarettes, any spare change, jokes for a dollar.
And you're going on to Portland?
Yes.
Where are you coming from?
From San Francisco.
And how did they treat you over there? And did you have a similar sign?
I had a similar sign, but it was, do you know who Rick and Morty are?
I do not.
Rick and Morty is a popular TV show on Cartoon Network on the Adult Swim part.
How did that sell?
It did good. It did really good. I made people on the tour buses smile. I made people walking by smile. This lady that owns Dragon Eats in on Hay Street, she used to put blessings out for me. Like, it was like a little 8-ounce cup filled with rice, and she put an incense on it.
Sounds nice.
Yeah, it was.
What about hard cash? Did you ever get any of that?
Not really too much. It was more smiles and whatnot.
But it felt worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people, like, they could have had the worst day possible, and I said the right thing at the right time, and the feeling of seeing the smile spread across their face, it's a beautiful thing.
I hear that. Anybody show up with a hamburger or a veggie burger?
Yeah. Dragon Eats, the lady that actually owns the shop, she used to put fresh sushi out for me every night.
How long were you there?
I was there for a month, but I got date raped twice while I was there, and I went through the crisis unit, and then I lost most of my stuff, and I decided it was time to get out of San Diego.
Time to move on.
Oh, yeah.
Where did you stay at night, usually? With people or by yourself, outside or inside?
By myself, outside.
How'd that go? Except for the date rapes.
Yeah, sometimes it was good. Other times, like, I'd wake up, and this isn't my original pack. I came with a much bigger pack, and somebody
pretty big pack
of my stuff. Yeah, it was a hell of a lot bigger when when I was in San Fran. I've lightened the load a bit. I gave a blanket away. I gave my road dog a blanket. It's been good.
In Spanish, your road dog?
Yes. Mad Max, the traveling veteran.
Hey, Max. Robert here.
What?
Both going to Portland, or?
Yeah.
Yes.
I was born in Portland. I don't necessarily recommend it, but...
Well, as long as you can stay away from the drugs and whatnot, like, it tends to be a pretty cool place. I used to stand outside the 7-Eleven most days and sell jokes and whatnot, and I used to bag on Trump a lot. I had a sign that said, "We'll teabag Trump for a sandwich."
And you got how many sandwiches?
I got lots of sandwiches. People used to see my sign, and they'd take pictures of me with my sign. The same thing with my Pickle Rick sign, but a bird shot on that.
That can be embarrassing, I guess.
Yeah, it was a pretty crappy situation.
Yes, I would imagine so.
Yeah.
Not horse shit, but bird shit.
Literally.
So what about Berkeley? How does it compare?
Berkeley's been nice so far. Other than this guy up until recently he got arrested, but he was spun out of his mind last night. He left some packages next to me, and it was his responsibility for him, and he was spun off, and he took off, and he told me to watch him. Well, I fell asleep from having to carry that lugging thing around all day, and I woke up, my Spain hat was gone, the packages were gone.
But your pack was still there.
Yeah, and he came back. And he started to harass me and say that I was going to get shot and that it was my fault and it wasn't my fault. And then my road dog, thank God, he woke up and we both started, when we stood our ground, we didn't attack him or nothing, but we stood our ground. And he went away and said that he was going to be back. And sure enough, today he was back and he started harassing us. And he started shouting all this racist stuff when nobody else was being racist but him. I told a joke to a black guy. I was like, "Why does Snoop Dogg carry an umbrella?" And the guy goes, "Why?" And I said, "For the drizzle, my nizzle." And he laughed. He laughed his ass off. But the guy behind me that had been harassing us since last night, he started shouting all this stuff about it being racist and how white folks shouldn't be using the word when nizzle is not racist. And I mean, Snoop Dogg talks a specific way, so it's like, why not? Freedom of speech. As long as I'm not hating on another race and whatnot, which I'm coexistent myself. I believe no matter what color we are, red, black, white, pink, yellow, blue, you know, gray, whatever, you cut us open, we all bleed the same. We all have the insides. So it should be peace and love. It should be unity.
Where have you slept mostly in San Francisco and here? Were you outside? And if so, was it in Golden Gate Park? Was it under a storefront?
Outside, usually at Golden Gate.
How did that go?
That went pretty good. Nobody bothered me.
How about the SF cops?
Hmm?
San Francisco police?
Some of them were nice. Other ones, not so nice. Like, we'd do our stuff, make smiles and laughs and whatnot, and then all of a sudden they'd tell us to leave the corner. And a lot of them, like this one guy, he threw a rock through somebody's apartment and they left, and then the cops came up and they were like, do we need to arrest anybody? And I was like, no sir, no. It's been pretty crazy. But the ones downtown, they were pretty nice. I'd sit down someplace and they'd give me at least a half hour to sit there, and then they'd be like, okay, you need to go on and do your thing.
But no croissant and coffee in the morning?
Nope, unfortunately.
Any contact with other homeless folks or organizations that have been helpful?
Not too many. I helped a lot of people over there. And
they didn't help back?
No, not really. A lot of them, they'd be nice to me while I was awake, and things would disappear while I was asleep, or I'd hear them talk about me when I went to go use the bathroom. And it's just, all I want is peace and love in mankind.
And instead you get date rape.
Yeah, instead I get date rape, stuff gets stolen, get lied to, get led astray.
You haven't given up?
Nope. With Yahweh in my heart, though I may walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil until I draw my last breath.
And we've been talking with?
Patrick Jones.
Any final thoughts, Patrick?
I just want peace and love for humanity. If we learn to coexist with each other, like Nickelback said, what was it? Nobody wants to go it on their own. Everyone wants to know they're not alone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are talking with.
Hello.
Hi. How's life on the road?
Life on the road is 80% suck, 20% good.
Right now, how would you describe it?
Right now, it's pretty sucking because I'm being harassed by some of the locals here.
I remember I was talking to your associate about a problem that developed because of parcels that were left behind and things of that sort. Any good experiences come to mind? I know it's kind of hard to remember them at a time like this.
Well, the good experiences in Berkeley are basically when you're flying a sign and you get that human interaction. It doesn't necessarily have to be money. It's just a smile, a wave, a hi, a good morning.
And that carries you through this.
Yes, sir.
Well, you have a sign, traveling that. I thought it said traveling veterinarian or traveling vegetarian, but it doesn't. It says traveling veteran.
Yes.
Is this your attempt to do recompense for the people killed in the wars? Or?
Well, this is my attempt at, you know, like letting my other country members know that I served in the military. And, you know, like, to be honest, the military kind of turned me into an alcoholic, or I turned into an alcoholic while I was in the military. And so here I am.
Are they providing any kind of treatment or assistance or things of that sort?
They are, but I'm on a waiting list that could take up to 6 months.
How long have you been on the waiting list?
For about 2 months now.
And where were you employed by the military? I should say held captive by the military.
Well, I was in the Army, and thankfully I didn't go to Afghanistan. I was in South Korea for 3 years.
Did you learn Korean?
Only a couple words.
Did you meet any attractive Korean sexual partners?
Yes.
Did you have any form of any human connections that you've retained over the years with those people?
No. They're all lost. They're all just temporary.
What about on the road, connections with people you've met?
Yes, only a couple people.
But you have met some?
Yes.
And you know, are there points of contact where you can return to see them again? And
yes, usually it's through email or through Facebook, and we could meet up again. But you know, being a traveler, people go certain ways. Like my other friend that I was really close friend with, his name was Tristan, and he's out in Arizona right now, and I'm out here in Berkeley, so we can't really meet up too quick right now.
How long have you been traveling with your associate here?
For about 8 days now.
And how is he as a traveling companion?
He is very good. Me and him both lift each other's spirits up when we're both down. Like, he'll be down one spot, and I'll lift him up, and I'll be down, and he'll lift me up. So it's a symbiotic relationship.
Rather than a parasitic relationship.
Yeah, true.
Anything you want to add, anything that you've experienced you want to